Hi, Dave Emery here, side two of For the Record program number 804, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, part two. This is being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2014. Due to the limitations of time, I'm going to plunge right back in where I left off at the end of side one. We were talking about Louis Farrakhan, the Nation of Islam, and their networking with Muslim Brotherhood elements. I have been told by people whose judgment I respect that the Nation of Islam has changed its catechism somewhat, but in the context of faith of any kind, to me, I reject what they call cheap grace. Anybody can pay lip service to religious or spiritual doctrines. The proof of the pudding is in the eating, so to speak. And in a miscellaneous archive show called Louis Farrakhan and the Politics of Murder, I analyze, among other things, Farrakhan's very suspicious behavior with regard to the assassination of Malcolm X, the man whose mantle he has assumed. What we're going to go into now might be termed Louis Farrakhan's Politics of Slavery. Farrakhan has written a book in which he blames African-American slavery on, you guessed it, the Jews. Moving beyond that, however, Farrakhan has been exculpatory of some very solid evidence that the Muslim Brotherhood government in Sudan has been engaged in the slave trade, which would make his statements perhaps indicative of the type of networking that we looked at in side one between Michael Boshuku and his OUNB and Ukrainian connections and the Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood links to Malaysia Air Flight 370, the Triple IT, and to the Nation of Islam and Farrakhan. Farrakhan spoke at the University of California, and personal to that, the Daily Californian of May 16th of 2012 had an article by Charles Jacob called Farrakhan's Secret Relationship. And after discussing Farrakhan's scapegoating of Jews for African-American slavery, he notes, what will be even more shocking, perhaps, is Minister Farrakhan's own semi-secret relationship with the modern-day slaving of African blacks by people and in countries that the Nation of Islam leader has an interest to protect. In 1994, an African Muslim from Mauritania, Mohammed Ati, A-T-H-I-E, and I broke the story of a modern-day slave trade in Mauritania and Sudan in the New York Times. We reported that, quote, perhaps 300,000, unquote, African Muslims were still serving Arab and the Berber masters. Black Africans in Mauritania were converted to Islam more than 100 years ago, we wrote, but while the Quran forbids the enslavement of fellow Muslims, in this country, race outranks religious doctrine. These people are chattel, used for labor, sex, and breeding. They may be exchanged for camels, trucks, guns, or money, and their children are the property of the master, unquote. In Sudan, again, headed at this point in time, headed by a Muslim Brotherhood government, in Sudan, Africa's largest country, we reported that slavery, quote, was making a comeback, the result of a 12-year-old war waged by the Muslim North against the black Christian and animist South. Arab militias, armed by the government, raid villages, mostly those of the Dinka tribe, shoot the men, and enslave the women and children. These are kept as personal property or marched north and sold, unquote. We based our reports on government documents, human rights publications, and a stunning interview with a UN official. The op-ed shocked many. We were encouraged to launch the American Anti-Slavery Group, which would document a modern-day slave trade around the globe, but would focus on Sudan and Mauritania as the worst case of slavery and the most controversial, and therefore least likely to be covered by others. PBS's Tony Brown Show, the most popular black news program at the time, invited Mohammed and me to speak about slavery. Immediately after our appearance, we were attacked by Farrakhan's spokesman who denied that blacks served Arab masters in Sudan, or worse, from NOI's point of view, that black Muslims served Arab Muslim masters in Mauritania. Farrakhan's calling, unquote, after all, funded in part by Arab dictator Muammar Gaddafi, was to break the black-Jewish civil rights alliance while teaching American blacks that Islam was their path to freedom. Not in Sudan and Mauritania, it wasn't. The Nation of Islam was serious about shutting us up. Samuel Cotton, a black reporter for the City Sun, New York's second largest black paper, conducted a thorough investigation that resulted in a five-part series, Arab Masters, Black Slaves, screamed across the front page in New York City's news kiosks. The Nation of Islam warned Samuel Cotton. They followed and menaced him when he spoke in Chicago, not far from their headquarters. Sam's book, Silent Terror, has become an underground classic. At a press conference in D.C. in 1996, Farrakhan was asked about reports of slavery in Sudan. According to the New York Times, he angrily challenged them, quote, "If slavery exists, go to the Sudan and come back and let the American people know what you found." The Baltimore Sun sent two reporters to Sudan where they found and liberated slaves and published a special four-page insert in the paper's weekend edition. Farrakhan refused their request for an interview and pretty much went into radio silence on slavery issues until fairly recently. And more about Farrakhan in the from the www.iabolish.org website. There's an article, Genocide and Slavery in the Sudan, The Farrakhan Connection, by Sabit Abe Ale. And there's this interesting excerpt. Speaking of Farrakhan, this was clearly demonstrated during his Savior Day address on February 25th, 1996, and in subsequent speeches, where the minister graphically described the people of South Sudan as being very, 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 very dark with kinky hair, as compared to the brown, parenthetically white northern Arabs, who, according to Farrakhan, looked exactly like him. He used the adverb very 15 times to emphasize his color prejudice against the southern Sudanese. Again, this is perhaps a bit of a diversion for some people, but this is to illustrate the networking of the Malaysian Muslim Brotherhood milieu with which Michael Bashirku is networked, as well as his networking with an OUNB sympathetic network. And bear in mind that he is the OSCE's special monitoring mission head in Ukraine and sort of the go-to guy for the disappearance of Malaysian, or the shootdown of Malaysian Airlines MH17. Now, more about that. As we noted last week, among the interesting aspects of the plane was the fact that what some people viewed as the, if not the creme de la creme of AIDS researchers, some very important AIDS researchers were on their way to an AIDS conference in Australia. And in the view of many objective observers, this would do a great deal of damage to AIDS research. From the Australian of July 18th of 2014, an article by Rick Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N, delegates to Melbourne AIDS Summit on doomed Flight 17, reads in part, "More than 100 AIDS activists, researchers, and health workers bound for a major conference in Melbourne were on the Malaysian Airlines flight downed in the Ukraine. It is believed that delegates to the 20th International AIDS Conference, due to begin on Sunday, will be informed today that 108 of their colleagues and family members died on MH17. And I would note that as well as Islamists of the Muslim Brotherhood stripe, so to speak, the homophobic OUNB successors such as Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, and also perhaps those national security elements in the U.S., Germany, and the underground Reich that are implicated in the development of AIDS, as I've talked about in many programs, For the Record 606, AFA 16, and others. None of those elements would be at all sorry if some of the world's top AIDS researchers suddenly went down on a plane. Doesn't prove anything, but it is an interesting coincidence. And I would note the following. In For the Record 803, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, Part 1, we talked about we accessed a number of posts by Robert Perry of Consortium News in which U.S. spy satellites appear to show men in Ukrainian army uniforms, possibly drunk with empty beer bottles lying around, as being the apparent culprits in the shootdown of MH Flight 17. ETN, Global Travel Industry News, which caters to business travelers and travelers in general, of July 17th of 2014, the day the plane went down, had a very interesting post. This one, Ukraine air traffic controller suggests Kiev military shot down passenger plane. ETN received information from an air traffic controller in Kiev on Malaysia Airlines flight MH17. This Kiev air traffic controller is a citizen of Spain and was working in the Ukraine. He was taken off duty as a civil air traffic controller along with other foreigners immediately after a Malaysia Airlines passenger aircraft was shot down over the eastern Ukraine, killing 295 passengers and crew on board. The air traffic controller suggested in a private evaluation and basing it on military sources in Kiev that the Ukrainian military was behind the shootdown. Radar records were immediately confiscated after it became clear that the passenger jet had been shot down. Military air traffic controllers in internal communication acknowledged that the military was involved, and some military chatter said they did not know where the order to shoot down the plane originated from. Skipping down. Radar screenshots also show an unexplained change of course of the Malaysian Boeing. The change of course took the aircraft directly over the eastern Ukraine conflict region. And more about that change of course from the Times of India of July 20th of 2014. Air India flight was 90 seconds away when missile struck Malaysian Airlines flight MH, it says 117, I thought it was MH flight 17. This by Manu, the MH 17. And again, more about this change of course. An Air India Dreamliner flight going from Delhi to Birmingham was in fact less than 25 kilometers away from a Malaysian aircraft, a distance covered by a Dreamliner or Boeing 777 in about 90 seconds when the latter was hit. Because of this closeness, the Dnepropetrovsk local Ukrainian air traffic controller asked the Air India pilots to try and establish contact with pilots of the Malaysian aircraft who had stopped responding to its calls. Minutes before the crash caused by a missile strike, the Air India pilots had also heard the controller giving the Malaysian aircraft MH17 what is called a, quote, direct routing, unquote. This permits an aircraft to fly straight instead of tracking the regular route, which is generally a zigzag track that goes from one ground-based navigation aid or waypoint to another. Quote, direct routing saves fuel and time and is preferred by pilots. In this case, it proved fatal, unquote, said an airline source. The question, of course, is was that deliberate and predetermined? I would note simply in passing that the Boeing 777 is a relatively fuel-efficient airplane, and in a war zone with active aerial warfare going on, one might have thought that they would have preferred to be safe rather than sorry, but again, we will never know. Another remarkable coincidence. Now, bear in mind that there aren't many airliners that go down each year. Far fewer still go down as a result of obvious hostile human action, and it is incredibly unusual for two airliners from the same airline to go down as a result of obvious human hostile action within a relatively short period of time. One of the only ones I can think of offhand was the September 11th attacks, which again connect through the IIIG, Operation Green Quest, the raids milieu, to the milieu involved with the disappearance of Malaysian Air Flight 370. That same milieu networks with Michael Bashirku. Interestingly enough, a Dutch cyclist, a guy named Martin de Jong, was booked to be on both the Malaysian Air Flight 370 that left from Kuala Lumpur and went, who knows, and the Malaysian Airlines Flight MH17. And at the last minute, he changed his flight. A remarkable coincidence, possible but extremely unlikely from an actuarial standpoint. The Independent from the UK of July 20th, 2014, Dutch cyclist Martin Mbarten de Jong, last name J-O-N-G-E, cheats death twice after changing flights from both Malaysia Airlines MH17 and MH370, an article by Adam Withnall, W-I-T-H-N-A-L-L, reads in part, a Dutch cyclist has revealed how he twice cheated death after changing his plans to fly on both the Malaysia airliner passenger jets involved in international aviation disasters over the past 4 months. Martin Bijan, 29, has to travel around the world to compete for Malaysia's Tengagu cycling team, and in so doing has now had two extraordinary near misses. And he mentions how he was scheduled to be on each of those planes. He decided to get off of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, he says, when he found out that traveling via Frankfurt would prove cheaper. One would think that in the digital age he would have had that all worked out in advance. I would also note in passing, he then routed himself through Germany, a major player in this. Now, again, this proves nothing, but that is extremely unlikely from an actuarial standpoint, and it raises a lot of interesting questions. He said he wasn't going to make any more public commentary out of respect for the families. I wonder if perhaps his control, his case officer, told him to shut the bleep up. I would also note that Michael Pashurku says that he and his fellow first arrivers, so to speak, saw all sorts of horrible things that they will never talk about. I wonder what those things might be and why he won't talk about them. Although it proves nothing, I would note there will be an upcoming program, and we're going to talk about Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, an SS officer and spy for IG Farben, founder of the Bilderberg Group and an apparent operative of the Underground Reich. Other members of the Dutch royal family appear to have followed in the Underground Reich footsteps of Prince Bernhard. We will be doing a program about that shortly. I would note that yet one of those members is Mabel Smits, S-M-I-T-S, formerly the lover of Mohamed Sasser Bey, former prime minister of Bosnia. And she has been very active, along with George Soros, in a, quote, charity, unquote, that appears to have been funding jihadist activity in, among other places, Chechnya. The Militant Islam Monitor of May 8th of 2012, Mabel, wife of comatose Dutch prince, resigns as CEO of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-American think tank, The Elders. Speaking of Ms. Smith, she was the chairwoman of the EU branch of George Soros' Open Society Institute and also chaired a charity called War Child. And we, in the past, we have talked about George Soros as probably being what I have called a Bormann Jew. Speaking about this charity, Prince Fizo of Holland has announced that, quote, they have decided to stop all support to their partner organization in Chechnya, saying that they can no longer guarantee the effective and controlled managing of the funds. And apparently it had gone to fund jihadist activity in Chechnya. In For the Record 381, as well as in the For the Record 773 about the Boston Marathon bombing, we have looked at some firm evidence that there is jihadist activity being actively sponsored by underground Reich-linked elements of Western intelligence and perhaps Saudi Arabia, well, certainly Saudi Arabia, in Chechnya as well. Sort of like in the Third Reich period when there were armies driving east across Ukraine and von Paulus' Sixth Army swung under and tried to capture the oil-rich Caucasus. In our last program, we talked about something called the Azov Battalion. Now, that is a fascist combatant organization of the Ukrainian government active in eastern Ukraine. And we talked about a Swedish Nazi sniper called Michael Schilt. I'm going to pronounce it that way, S-K-I-L-L-T. He is, again, a member of a Swedish fascist party and is fighting with the Azov Battalion, and there is information developed from him in the all-important German foreign, the very useful GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter that he also knew of two other foreign-born snipers serving with the Azov battalion who had been present, according to him, at the Euromaidan demonstrations that led to the coup and were there to neutralize snipers, marksmen of the Ukrainian forces of Mr. Yanukovych. And again, it was the shooting that took place at those demonstrations that led to the coup. From the GermanForeignPolicy.com newsletter of July 30th, 2014, there's a post, Ukrainian Patriots. Now, notice here not only that Michael Schilt has indicated there were foreign-born snipers at the Euromaidan to fire at Ukrainian government marksmen, but note that one of the founders of the Azov battalion that we spoke about last week is a fellow named Oleg Lyashko, L-Y-S-A-S-H-K-O. He also heads up the Radical Party. That is an extreme right-wing party which polled 23.2% of prospective voters in a recent poll. And together with Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, that will give them a dominant fascist parliamentary coalition. Again, from GermanForeignPolicy.com of July 30th of this year, 5 months after the Kiev coup, vigorously supported by Berlin, a right-wing extremist party may become pro-Western Ukraine's strongest political force. According to a recent survey, the radical party of the ultra-right-wing politician Oleg Lyashko could currently expect 23.2% of the votes. Lyashko made himself a name with his brutality against the Kiev regime's eastern Ukrainian opponents. He is also co-founder and supporter of the Azov Battalion, a militia of over 100 mainly fascist combatants, including a Swedish neo-Nazi sniper. He has reported that other snipers had already been in action for the opposition during the Euromaidan protests. It has never been revealed who fired the fatal shots on February 20th. In this highly charged atmosphere, the Ukrainian government is taking steps that indicate a political cultural development even further to the right. And skipping down of Lyashko, on his website on May 7th, for example, he published a video of himself interrogating a nearly naked, bleeding eastern Ukrainian insurgent prisoner. In last May's municipal council elections, leading members of the fascist organization Social National Assembly and Patriot of Ukraine ran on the electoral list of Lyashko's Radical Party. According to the survey, the fascist Svoboda Party would receive 5.7% and the militarist Pravi Sektor 1.9% of the votes. Together with the 23.2% for the Radical Party, ultra-right-wing parties would poll nearly one-third of the votes, skipping down. The Azov Battalion recently caused an international stir when it was reported that neo-Nazis from various other European countries, such as Italy, France, and Sweden, are also members of the unit. Apparently, the battalion is being trained professionally. A Georgian Special Forces trainer is said to be among the instructors. The Azov Battalion is one of three special commandos, with the Dnipro and Donbass battalions being set up in pro-Western Ukraine. The Swedish neo-Nazi Michael Schilt is a member of the Azov Battalion. Schilt, a member of the fascist Svenskarnas Party, or Party of the Swedes, says that he has at least three purposes in the unit. The commander, as commander of the small reconnaissance unit, a sniper, and sometimes he works as a special coordinator for clearing houses and going into civilian areas, unquote. The person who is rumored to have been captured by East Ukrainian insurgents has been a sniper for 6 years in the Swedish military. He says he has only been engaged in the Ukrainian conflict since March. He admits, however, to having spoken to at least two snipers who, during the Maidan protests, had shot at police from the trade union house in Kiev, at the time the headquarters of the protesters. Their mission was to take out Berkut's snipers, unquote, explained Schilt. The deadly shots from the Maidan, which in Western propaganda has been used to legitimize the overthrow of President Viktor Yanukovych, has never been investigated by the Putsch regime, and Berlin, parenthetically, and Washington have never applied pressure for an investigation. I would note, in for the record, 8:03, our last show, we talked about how after the city of Slovyansk was recaptured from rebel forces, the Pravysektor UNA banner was seen flying over the Interior Ministry building. Consider that in connection with the following very interesting little blurb in an otherwise propaganda piece published by the New York Times. The New York Times is in Warren Report mode these days. The New York Times of August 1st of 2014 by Andrew Higgins, a test for Ukraine in city retaken from rebels. The new authorities, promising anonymity, have set up a hotline for residents to inform on rebel collaborators, and they have printed flyers warning that a new law mandates up to 15 years in jail for separatism. Of course, people are afraid, Dr. Grushenko said. They are afraid of being punished, unquote. Well, basically, that anonymous informing hotline would be going straight to people like the Azov Battalion, Pravysektor, Svoboda, etc. There is an article called The Durability of Ukrainian Fascism by Peter Lee, which has an interesting thing about the heritage of the Pravysektor. It notes, Yuri Shukovich's role in modern Ukraine, in modern Ukrainian fascism, is not simply that of an inspirational figurehead and reminder of his father's anti-Soviet heroics for proud Ukrainian nationalists. He is a core figure in the emergence of the key Ukrainian fascist formation Pravysektor and its paramilitary. And Pravysektor's paramilitary, the UNA-UNSO, is not an unruly collection of weekend warrior wannabes, as Mr. Higgins might believe. UNA-UNSO was formed during the turmoil of the early 1990s, largely by ethnic Ukrainian veterans of the Soviet Union's bitter war in Afghanistan. From the first, the UNA-UNSO has shown a taste for foreign adventures, sending detachments to Moscow in 1990 to oppose the communist coup against Yeltsin, and to Lithuania in 1991. With apparently very good reason, the Russians have accused UNA-UNSO fighters of participating on the anti-Russian side in Georgia and Chechnya. After formal Ukrainian independence, the militia elected Yuri Shukievich, the son of OUNB commander Roman Shukievich, as its leader, and set up a political arm which later became Pravysektor. By the way, Roman Shukievich headed up the Einsatzgruppe Noctegal, which liquidated much of the Polish and Jewish population of Lviv. A street was named in their honor after the overthrow of Yanukovych. I would also note in another German foreignpolicy.com post of July 21st called Established Facts, quote, after a jetliner was shot down over eastern Ukraine, influential German foreign policy experts have begun calling for a military intervention, which may include German Bundeswehr units. A blue helmet mission under the umbrella of the United Nations, unquote, should now be taken into consideration, declared Andreas Schöckenhoff, co-chairman of the CDU-CSU group in the Bundestag. So again, consider the possibility of MH17 as a provocation. The interesting information coming from Michael Schilt certainly would suggest that the OUNB heirs in the Ukraine are subject to something of a culture of provocation. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 804, Walking the Snake in Ukraine, being recorded on August 3rd of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.